Now, last time we discussed holiness, and I'm not sure, I'm more at a loss for words, which is rare for me, nor do I feel less adequate than when we're discussing holiness. It is a much more expansive and controversial issue than one might have thought. What makes it controversial is not that the Bible doesn't give us sufficient detailed and consistent information that well defines the essence and the operation of holiness, but rather humans have chosen to ignore and disregard entire sections of the Bible and take only from the remainder our definitions for most things, holiness being one of them. So the concept of holiness has been greatly watered down and has been made passive, if not entirely subjective. Now, how did it strike you in some of our last lessons in Numbers to learn that Numbers, Exodus and Leviticus as well, explain that holiness and uncleanness can be transferred from a person to an object, from an object to another object, from a person by physical contact? Or that holiness is dangerous? Or that only some people are authorized to have it, and those who are not authorized are subject to grave consequences if they go ahead and contract holiness anyway? See, this is a hard teaching, but I want to remind you, we're reading the Bible, not a commentary. It's there. It's in full living color, blunt and unequivocal. It's really a matter of whether or not we want to accept what it says. But be forewarned, we've not yet learned all the Bible has to say about holiness. Nor does holiness stand alone as an attribute of God. Other factors, like his omniscience, his justice, his love, his mercy, his salvation, his severity and wrath, to name just a few, they all play roles in his character. They all work together. God never acts one-dimensionally. That is, only in justice, or only in mercy, or only in wrath. But there is no way to understand each of these aspects of the Lord without untangling them, isolating, examining them as best we can. And while holiness is simply asserted as a fact in the New Testament, where we're going to find holiness explained, holiness defined, is in the Old Testament, primarily the Torah. Now, because of the era the church has been immersed in for almost 2,000 years, an era that I think is drawing to a close, the mission of the church has generally been to grow through evangelizing. And the job has been done overall quite well. Unfortunately, what seems to have suffered along the way is the maturation process of the individual believer. This is what Paul calls the perfecting of the saints. Those who wish to move forward into a deeper faith, greater knowledge of the Lord, haven't had a lot of encouragement or support. It's a little like a community with a burgeoning population that has focused on building excellent, new, state-of-the-art elementary schools for the children. But as the children have matriculated through each grade, so many resources were spent on the elementary level that the community neglected to build a high school. So at some point, there was no choice but to repeat the same educational material over and over and over. Perhaps in a slightly different form, maybe a little bit different style, but then it's declared that it's actually deeper enlightenment, even though it's always the same thing. The 15-year-old effectively sits in the same classroom with the 10-year-old, hearing the elementary school level curriculum yet again. And the elementary material's not wrong. It's not defective. But neither does it challenge. It doesn't advance the child to the next natural level of maturity that's needed. And as applied to believers, this perfection process that Paul speaks of is stunted, and we're held back. Yet graduating into higher education brings with it its own set of anxieties and problems. When we're children, the rules are pretty black and white, hard and fast. Instructions are basic. There's not a lot of room allowed or tolerated for children to make value judgments on their own. Because first, the foundation must be well established for determining those values. Therefore, as most of us have already learned the basics of God's plan of salvation, who Yeshua is, what he expects of us, what seems to lie ahead in the future, it's natural for us to leave behind the comforts of knowing only the primary colors and turn our attention instead to the more difficult matters of the many hues and tones of our faith. The difficulty is that the black and white edges we were so used to begin to blur. The answers aren't always apparent and succinct. Faith is much easier in the black and white stage than it is as we advance. That is why it is said that we must first come to Christ in the beginning as little children, willing to begin with the basics, accept them as truth, just as they are, not much explanation, and even less questioning on our parts. But later, we are fully expected to embrace the struggle to advance in godly wisdom and understanding, because it's this struggle that keeps us glued to God and moving forward. And in consideration of our current topic, holiness, we find it's a whole lot easier to just look holy than to be holy. The problem with holiness is that while it is intrinsic to God's character, it's certainly not to ours. Humans are only truly holy when God is near and when he endows us with his holiness. Now, it's not as though some effort on our part to attain and maintain holiness is not needed. It is. But the effort is aimed mostly at trusting God, following his plan, not making our own way, devising our own rules. Korah, Datan, Aviram, and all their followers made a supreme effort to attain holiness. But the effort was in opposition to God's plan and to his commandments. Even though a measure of holiness was indeed attained, because God's holiness is so powerful that its mere proximity will automatically infect whatever is near him with holiness, it wasn't attained in accordance with his plan. And as a consequence, God's attribute of his justice came into play. And according to God's justice, those rebels who attained this unauthorized holiness against his rules, against his ordinance, they felt his wrath. They were destroyed. On the other hand, the priests who had been set apart, had been authorized by God for holiness, they attained that holiness legitimately and therefore safely. We're going to veer away from the holiness topic for a time. And in Numbers chapter 19, we're going to find an intriguing discussion about a specific type of impurity and what to do about it. Now recall that impure, unclean, it's the same thing. So as we leave the issue of holiness, just keep this in mind. The holiness that is inside you is God. He put himself there. Further, that holiness can be defiled. The advent of Yeshua does not change how holiness operates. It's our job as disciples of Yeshua to see to it that his holiness that is housed within these frail, temporary, imperfect sanctuaries, tents that are our bodies, his holiness is protected. And the beginning of doing that is being open to learning what holiness actually is, according to the Bible, as opposed to doctrines of men. Now, because of the evangelical church's renewed interest in prophetic happenings in the end times, most of us have at least heard about the red heifer and of a group of Jews' constant search for a perfect one. This special red-colored cow is needed when the long-hoped-for temple is rebuilt in Jerusalem. It's not a tradition. It is absolutely required. Here in Numbers is where the purpose and the details of that red heifer ritual are pronounced. Now, although we have to go through several verses of the ritual procedure before we get to its purpose, it turns out that it's all about decontaminating a person who has become unclean because they touched a human corpse. So, let's open our Bibles to Numbers chapter 19. We're going to read the whole chapter. Numbers 19, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 171. Adonai said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the regulation from the Torah which God has commanded. Tell the people of Israel to bring you a young red female cow without fault or defect and which has never borne a yoke. You are to give it to Eleazar the Kohen, the priest. It is to be brought outside the camp and slaughtered in front of him. Eleazar the priest is to take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle this blood towards the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. The heifer is to be burned to ashes before his eyes. Its skin, meat, blood, and dung is to be burned to ashes. The Kohen is to take cedar wood, hyssop, and scarlet yarn and throw them onto the heifer as it's burning up. Then the Kohen, the priest, is to wash his clothes and himself in water, after which he may re-enter the camp. But the priest will remain unclean until evening. The person who burned up the heifer is to wash his clothes and himself in water, but he will remain unclean until evening. A man who is clean is to collect the ashes of the heifer and store them outside the camp in a clean place. They are to be kept for the community of the people of Israel to prepare water for purification from sin. The one who collected the ashes of the heifer is to wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. For the people of Israel and for the foreigner staying with them, this will be a permanent regulation. Anyone who touches a corpse, no matter whose dead body it is, will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with these ashes on the 3rd and 7th day, then he'll be clean. But if he does not purify himself the 3rd and 7th days, he will not be clean. Anyone who touches a corpse, no matter whose dead body it is, and does not purify himself, has defiled the tabernacle of Adonai. That person will be cut off from Israel because the water for purification wasn't sprinkled on him. He will be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. This is the law. When a person dies in a tent, everyone who enters the tent and everything in that tent will be unclean for 7 days. Every open container without a cover closely attached is unclean. And whoever is in an open field and touches a corpse, whether of someone killed by a weapon, or of someone who died naturally, or the bone of a person, or a grave, will be unclean for 7 days. For the unclean person, they are to take some of the ashes of the animal burned up as a purification from sin and add them to fresh water in a container. A clean person is to take a bunch of hyssop leaves, dip it in the water, sprinkle it on the tent, on all the containers, on the people who were there, and on the person who touched the bone or the person killed or the one who died naturally or the grave. The clean person will sprinkle the unclean person on the third and seventh day. And on the seventh day, he will purify him. Then he'll wash his clothes and himself in water, and he will be clean at evening. The person who remains unclean and does not purify himself will be cut off from the community because he's defiled the sanctuary of Adonai. The water for purification has not been sprinkled on him. He's unclean. This is to be a permanent regulation for them. The person who sprinkles the water for purification is to wash his clothes. Whoever touches the water for purification will be unclean until evening. Anything the unclean person touches will be unclean. Anyone who touches him will be unclean until that evening. So much of what we've just read in this chapter, previous ones, about these elaborate rituals can't help but seem to us moderns as mumbo jumbo. Sorcery. Stuff we kind of expect some deep jungle tribes of the Brazilian rainforest to practice. And that is because Christians have generally set aside ritual as unimportant, unneeded, unintelligent, almost, in the practice of our faith. We don't see its value any longer. In fact, unless perhaps we are Catholic or one of the Eastern Orthodox churches, we don't really like it. We aren't comfortable with talking about ritual. But contained within biblical ritual is the visible picture of what's going on in an invisible spiritual realm. Believe me, long before the church was around, rabbis struggled with the words to explain just why ritual was performed. What actually occurred during these sacred procedures, just like we do today? Did the blood and the body parts of sacrificed animals actually take on supernatural qualities? Did sacred procedures done in exactly the right way in order create a magic-like effect upon the people of Israel? Does bathing in water and saying all the right words at the right time somehow react with our flesh and our souls so as to remove whatever it is that's contaminated us and offended God in the process? So as important as this chapter of Numbers and its details is, so is the need for us to take another step in understanding the biblical principles surrounding ritual purity. Or rather, ritual impurity. Now, I want to begin by quoting a brief story from the Talmud about a famous rabbi who was asked to explain the very issue I just framed for you. Here goes. A heathen questioned Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, saying, "The things you Jews do appear to be a kind of sorcery. A cow is brought, it's burned, it's pounded into ash, its ash is gathered up, and then, when one of you gets defiled by contact with a corpse, two or three drops of the ash mixed with water are sprinkled on him, and he's told, 'You're cleansed.'" And Rabbi Yochanan asked the heathen, "Has the spirit of madness ever possessed you?" And he replied, "No." And the rabbi said, "Have you ever seen a man whom the spirit of madness possessed?" And the heathen said, "Yes." And the rabbi said, "And what do you do for such a man?" And the heathen replied, "Well, roots are brought, and the smoke of their burning is made to rise up about him, and the water sprinkled upon him until the spirit of madness flees him." And Rabbi Yochanan said, "Do not your ears hear what your mouth is saying? It is the same with a man who is defiled by contact with a corpse. He too is possessed by a spirit, the spirit of uncleanness. And scripture says, 'I will make false prophets as well as the unclean spirit vanish from the land.'" Now, when the heathen left, Rabban Johanan's disciples said, "Our master, you put off that heathen with a mere reed of an answer. But what answer will you give us?" And he answered, "By your lives, I swear, the corpse does not have the power by itself to defile. Nor does that mixture of ash and water have the power by itself to cleanse. The truth is that the purifying power of the red cow is the decree from the Holy One." The Holy One said, "I've set it down as a statute. I have issued it as a decree. You're not permitted to transgress my decree. This is the ritual law." The rabbi is saying, "I'm not entirely sure how this whole thing works. But I do know that that red cow has no magical power in itself. I do know that a corpse can't inherently defile anybody. In the end, we do this red heifer purification procedure because God said to do it. And if we do it, he'll count us as purified, and it's just not permitted to do otherwise. It's an issue of obedience, not of magic." So the good rabbi is denying that any kind of sorcery is involved, and he readily admits that it all sure looks like a bunch of mumbo-jumbo pagan exorcism. But it's not. And part of the reason it's not is that he says God has said he will banish unclean spirits from the land of Israel. So it's impossible that a contaminated man could even have an unclean spirit in him. But what also throws the rabbi off, though it's not easily seen in this Talmud story, is that there is a very strange paradox in Numbers 19 about the workings of the red heifer's ashes upon the defiled man who touched the corpse. Let's take a close look at what we call the red heifer sacrifice. Let's see just where that paradox lays. The first thing we notice in verse 2 is that the animal involved is a red cow, which we usually call a red heifer. This is, of course, a female animal. It's young, but older than a yearling, and it has never been used for work. It means it's never been used for a common purpose. It's never been yoked to a plow. This animal must be unblemished, as are all animals designated for ritual slaughter. Next and most importantly, we're told that the red cow must be taken outside the camp to be slaughtered. This represents the first element of the paradox. This red heifer, which is to be used as the primary ingredient in an especially important ritual purification concoction, is going to be killed in an unclean place. Recall just what outside the camp means. The only ritually clean ground is inside the camp. Inside the camp is where the Israelites live. In time, this area became more defined, and actual measurements were assigned to it. City limits, if you would. Do not confuse ritually clean with ritually holy. The only ritually holy ground was within the temple or tabernacle courtyard, which was at the center of the ritually clean camp. So somewhere outside the camp, in an unclean place, a special altar was erected. In point of fact, altar is probably much too strong of a word for it. This was merely a large but common wood fire mound upon which this red cow was killed and burned up. And the general procedure was that a priest of high order, not the high priest, and in our example in Numbers, this was Eleazar, the son of Aaron, he accompanied the red cow to the woodpile and officiated the ceremony. Sometimes the high priest would be involved. It just depended on the era. In any case, the high priest or his, someone under him, maybe his son, would cut the throat of the cow. Then he would gather some of its blood in a ceremonial vessel. He'd then turn and he'd face the door to the sanctuary with some blood on his finger, and he'd sprinkle it towards the sanctuary 7 times. Of course, he was a long distance away, so a line of sight had to be established. You see that in this picture. Line of sight had to be established so he could literally see the door into the holy place, that first chamber inside the sanctuary. And after this entire cow, every part of it, was burned up whole atop this huge bonfire, while the cow was being burned up, the priest would throw cedar wood and hyssop, sometimes called oregano, and a red-colored thread into it. It was all to be consumed as well. In essence, the wood and the hyssop and the thread were kind of being added to the mixture. Now, upon completing his task, the priest had to remove his priestly garment, and he had to bathe in water. And after putting on fresh garments, then he could re-enter the camp, but he remained, we're told, in a ritually unclean state until the sunset, indicating the end of the current day and the beginning of the next. Whoever assisted him in this operation also had to remove and wash their garments, take a bath, and they too remained in a state of impurity until the sun went down. Next, a man who had not participated in any of the ritual up to this point, so he was still ritually clean, was to gather up all the ashes, put them in a designated place where they could then be used to combine with water and so make this special purification liquid for use as was needed. This man who gathered the ashes became defiled. So, as with all others involved, he had to wash his clothes, he had to take a bath, and he had to remain in an unclean state until the sun went down, the end of the day. Because the level of impurity, of contact with death, usually meaning human death, was so great, it could not only defile whoever or whatever touched it, it could even defile whoever or whatever was in close proximity to it. However, that which actually came into contact with the dead body was contaminated with a greater degree of impurity than whatever was merely nearby it. The remedy for this impurity caused by a dead body was this mixture of ashes from the red heifer and water. The mixture was sprinkled on the home or the building where this person died. It was also sprinkled on whoever came into contact with that person. The sprinkling procedure occurred twice. The first time was on the third day after the defilement. The second time was on the seventh day after the defilement. The defiled persons who had been properly sprinkled were then returned to a ritually pure status at the end of the seventh day, at which time they washed their clothes and they bathed. Now, this was no light matter. Anyone who became defiled from a corpse and didn't go through this ritual procedure was cut off. We've talked about this term, cut off, karet, in Hebrew. You can go review previous lessons for more information about it. In a nutshell, generally a person who was cut off, karet, lost his relationship with the people of Israel and, more importantly, with the God of Israel. A critical question arises. Why such a severe penalty? The answer for this drastic consequence is near the end of verse 20. The person who has been defiled by a dead body and refuses God's provision to be made clean, we're told, has defiled the Lord's sanctuary. God's holiness has been endangered. There is nothing more high-handed than to bring defilement into the dwelling place of Jehovah. Now keep that at the front of your mind as we continue on, because we're going to revisit that. So in the chapter, we're next told that the person, the clean person, who did the sprinkling of the ash and water mixture onto the defiled person, now finds himself in an unclean state. So now he, of course, has to wash his clothes, take a bath, wait until the sun goes down. New day. Even more, anyone who is currently ritually clean and even touches a drop of this special purification water, they become unclean. And whoever or whatever touches that unclean person, they become unclean. And this is the completion of the red heifer story. Let me begin the examination of this, I think, startling, kind of perplexing chapter at its end. Notice that just as in the previous chapter concerning holiness, that holiness could be inadvertently transmitted from one thing made holy to another thing. It's the same thing with impurity. Impurity can be inadvertently transmitted from one thing made unclean to another, whether it is objects or whether it's people. Now, I remind you what I said at the outset today. You can be uncomfortable with this. You can even not like it very much. But here it is in black and white. We just read it. This isn't an interpretation. This isn't taken from Hebrew traditions. This is not human commentary. This is the Bible. Therefore, we're obligated to deal with it as it is, not try to wish it away. So here we go. The dictionary says that a paradox is a situation or a statement that seems contradictory, not believable, or just absurd. And yet, it's very likely true. It's factual. And the paradox of the red heifer sacrifice is this. Everybody that has anything to do with its preparation, death, burning up, gathering of its ashes, they all become unclean. I mean, did you catch that? People who are exactly following God's commandment and the law, the ritual law of purification, they begin in a clean state but wind up becoming ritually impure for doing it. On the surface, that makes no sense at all. Can it be that we have Jehovah God ordering some holy and or clean people to intentionally become ritually defiled? The unclean person, unclean from touching a corpse, yet is made clean from these same ashes of the red heifer. But the clean persons who perform the ritual and apply the ashes, they're made unclean. The old switcheroo. And as the rabbis say about this procedure, the same ashes that purify the defiled defile the pure. How is this possible? I mean, this is so completely opposite from all the other sacrifices and their effects. The other sacrifices atone. Often they make clean. Typically, handling a sacrifice properly automatically brings a measure of holiness with it. In fact, the average citizen has to turn his sacrifice over to the priest to be put onto the brazen altar because only the priest is holy enough to get near the altar. Even the animal is considered holy, a higher status than just being clean, the moment the worshiper determines to offer it as a sacrifice. Otherwise, it wouldn't be even allowed into the holy precinct. So what gives here? Well, one of the difficulties in grasping the red heifer sacrifice, the regular temple sacrifices, all the accompanying temple rituals, is defining the term holy. The term holy in Hebrew is kodesh or kadosh, and it simply means to be separated away or set apart for a purpose. When my wife is getting ready to do laundry, she carefully separates types of materials, as well as light versus dark colored loads. It is perfectly within the meaning of kadosh or kodesh, to apply that Hebrew term to her separation, or rather to her separating one kind of color or cloth from another. Now, did she make a dark load holy and the light load something else? No. It's the context of the use of the term kadosh or kodesh that matters. It is used in a, is it used in a spiritual religious context or in some other context? A person could be kadosh for destruction. They could be kadesh for Satan. But both of these things are negative. Remember, holy is not a Hebrew word. It's an English word. It's an English word that's been used as a translation for the Hebrew kodesh or kadosh. It's only when something is kadosh for God, separated away for service to the Lord, then it carries with it the sense of holy as we think of holy. So the red heifer isn't so much holy. It's just kadosh. It's just set apart. But it's set apart not for service to God, like in a standard temple sacrifice. It's set apart for destruction. But this destruction is going to be used by God to make his people clean again. So it would be a mistake to apply the term holy as it's thought of in Christianity to this red heifer. Now, another key to understanding the red heifer ritual is to notice that the Torah calls this particular sacrifice in Hebrew a hat'at. And if you've been studying with me for a while, this is not the first time you've heard that Hebrew term hat'at. That is, the red heifer ritual belongs in a general classification of sacrifices of the hat'at category. And recall that early in our Leviticus study, we spent a lot of time with the various classifications of sacrifices, and each had their own God-ordained purpose. They're very deep and complex, so I'll only talk about the parts of the hat'at sacrifice that are pertinent to the red heifer ritual. Most Bible translators will render the Hebrew term hat'at as sin offering, but that is ambiguous and misses the purpose of it. Hat'at is better translated as purification offering. In other words, while it may well be a sin that eventually leads to the need for this hat'at, the effect of the hat'at is to decontaminate, to purify. In the standard hat'at sacrifice, the flesh of the animal may not be eaten, and the animal must be burned up outside the camp, just as with the red heifer ritual. But there are significant differences between the red heifer kind of hat'at sacrifice and the rather standard one. For instance, the blood taken, the blood of the red heifer is not removed and then splashed on the altar. Rather, the blood of the red heifer remains in the cow. It's not drained away. So all that's burned up as part of the ashes. This is because a bedrock principle of the sacrificial system is that blood is central to the entire process. The hat'at, the regular Levitical purification offering, is a most unique sacrifice because one of its effects is to make its handlers and its officials impure. And of course, what we find that exact thing also applies to the red heifer ritual here in Numbers 19. I mean, what a strange thing. What could possibly be the reason that God would design a sacrifice that generates impurity? Well, here's the reason for it. The sacrificial animal, in our case, it's the red heifer, purifies by means of effectively absorbing the defiled person or object's impurities. The hat'at animal sacrifice behaves like a a spiritual sponge. And since the Hata'at sacrificial animal serves its purpose by soaking up the certain types of contamination it was meant to absorb, it now becomes contaminated with an enormous amount of impurity, so it has to be destroyed. It is so dangerously impure, it has to be destroyed away from anything holy. It even has to be away from anything clean. The camp of Israel is clean, so it can't be offered up on the holy altar. It has to be destroyed far away from anything holy on a common fire outside the camp. In fact, technically, the Hata'at sacrifice isn't offered up to God. It's set apart for a purpose. It is kadosh for a purpose, but that purpose is not to be set apart for God. Only things set apart for God, kadosh for God, can be offered to the Lord. Now, the concept of set apart for common purposes versus set apart for God also comes into play with the use of the fire that's used to burn up this animal. The fire of the brazen altar is a divinely positive kind of fire. It transforms. It purifies because it is used to offer up the smoke to the Lord. The common wood fire that consumes the red heifer is only meant to destroy it. It's meant to just get rid of it, rid of whatever is put on it. Because what's on it's dangerous and defiled. It's not unlike the burning up, the careful burning up of medical waste. Now, we recently discussed that God's holiness is so powerful, kind of like nuclear radiation, that everything that comes near to it is irradiated with holiness and so attains a measure of holiness itself. It's that same kind of effect with the red cow that becomes so full of the worst sorts of impurities from soaking up the defilement from others that everything that comes near it, every object, every human, they are irradiated with uncleanness. Now, I want to point out something else quite unique about this red heifer sacrifice. It is not the one who performs the ritual sacrifice who gets the benefit of it. In fact, it is the same way for any Hata'at category of sacrifice. The blood of the animal is not used to purify the worshiper or to atone for him. That is, in the regular Hata'at sacrifice, the blood of the animal is splashed on the altar and in certain instances on other sanctuary furnishings because the animal blood is performing a purification function. In the red heifer sacrifice, the blood of the animal is left in the animal, so it just becomes part of the ashes. And when all that's mixed with water, that winds up being splashed on the person who is in need of decontamination and purification. In other words, the foundational purpose of the standard Hata'at sacrifice is to use the blood of the animal for the purpose of purifying the sanctuary, tabernacle or temple, and all of its sacred objects. It's not used to purify the one who brings the offering, and it's not offered up to God. Now, let me put a couple of pieces together for you. Recall now what it says in verse 20, that if anyone does not purify themselves with the red heifer ashes with water, from the uncleanness of death, because they touched a dead body, they will be cut off. They will have their relationship with the congregation of Israel ended. They will have their relationship with God terminated. Why this severe penalty? Because the consequence of a person contracting uncleanness from a corpse is it defiles God's sanctuary. It is the defilement of God's sanctuary that's the issue. Therefore, it is the defilement of God's sanctuary that has to be remedied. Bottom line to all this, The ashes of the red heifer, when mixed with living water, are designed to purify the sanctuary of God. And it has also long been understood within Judaism that the people of God are in some mysterious way also sanctuaries of God. See, this concept's not a new Christian invention. That's their only use. No wonder the good rabbi in our story had such a hard time explaining just why ashes that were obviously meant to purify the temple of God were for some elusive reason also used in a ritual to purify a human being from the worst contamination there was, from contamination caused by contact with death. The rabbi didn't understand what we now know in hindsight, that eventually, once the Messiah had finished up giving up his life to atone for ours, that God would abandon the sanctuary that men had made for him and make men, humans, his new sanctuary in a fully literal way. The ritual picture that emerges here is to connect the sanctuary of God with humans. Are we not told that as believers, we are now the temple of God? And indeed, does not the Holy Spirit, who is God, literally live within these fragile tents that we call bodies? Then these tents must be purified and cleansed to be suitable for God to dwell there. Further, just like for the ancient tabernacle and temple, simply being in proximity to people and in contact with people and existing in a defiled world means that the sanctuary is going to be under constant bombardment of impurity. So, a regular purging of those impurities is mandatory. Recall Yeshua's crucifixion. When the Roman soldier wanted to determine if Jesus was actually dead, or maybe he'd just passed out, he reached up with a spear and he pierced his side. And what flowed out? Blood and water. Blood, we would expect. Why water? Because blood atones, but water purifies. And both actions are needed for us. Blood removes sin. Water removes uncleanness. Two different things. Two different spiritual elements. But our Savior Yeshua was sufficient for both. What was the purification mixture of Numbers chapter 19? Blood and water. The blood was in the ashes. It was left in the cow and burned up. Blood and water. The blood in the ashes of the red heifer mixed with the water of purification applied to a person contaminated with death. We'll continue with this next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.